This past week has actually seen the conclusion of a court case that really I did actually comment on it about a year ago, something like that. Reese Jones was a 10-year-old boy who was shot by some other boy riding a BMX mountain bike. And they couldn't, you know, locate the person involved. And now the actual murderer has in fact been jailed for 22 years altogether. And he's a 17-year-old. This particular paper, let's see which one was this one, Wednesday, December the 17th. It's got justice for Reese's mother as a cowardly killer gets 22 years. And it goes in, a judge condemned Britain's stupid, brutal gang culture yesterday as he jailed the teenage killer of schoolboy Reese Jones for at least 22 years. Mr. Justice Stephen Irwin poured scorn on the pretensions of Sean Mercer and his gang to be urban soldiers who commanded respect in the local community. And there's quite an article on it inside. And there's been a fair amount in the television as well in this past week. One thing that was interesting, though, was a quote that I saw. This was actually from today's paper, but I'd seen something similar about what it was, what kind of family life Sean Mercer had. You know, what actually generates this? Because this individual, he was an individual who was part of this particular gang, and he was taking a pot shot at this other gang member, opposing gang member, on the other side of a car park. And Reese Jones happened to be walking through the car park at the time, and he died. He got a shot in the neck, one of the shots. He fired three shots across the car park area. None of them hit any of the targets, but he then escaped on his mountain bike, got somebody to hide the gun, somebody who wasn't related to him at all and not part, you know, a very loose affiliation with a gang, then got other gang members to give him alibis, burned his clothes, swabbed himself completely down in petrol to remove all residues off his skin, and the entire, you know, he covered his trail I think he completely demolished and destroyed the mountain bike that he was on, so there'd be no gunpowder residue found. But the thing that the police had enormous difficulty until finally they happened to search the house where the gun was and found the gun, and that then led to the chain of events that finally tracked this killer down. But the thing that was interesting was what kind of family this particular boy came from. And it says, the conviction, this is the killing runs in the dishonest family. It says, the conviction of the scum who murdered and abetted the murder of 11-year-old Reese Jones lifted the stone on the most revolting aspects of our underclass. The murderer's mother was a prostitute. His father, from whom his mother is of course separated, was mixed up with drug gangs, one of whose members shot him in 1996. His great-great-grandfather was hanged for murder. At least then we dealt with such people effectively. The cocktail of the destruction of the family, the wreck of the state education, the poisonous liberal society, and now rewarding the undeserving poor through welfare has created a feral group who won't work, won't be honest, and won't conform with the law. If the government wishes to prime the economy, it should bulldoze the Norris Green estate in Liverpool, where the murderer and his gang live, split up the gang by redistributing them around the country, preferably to remote islands, and until we stop paying people to be an underclass, we'll have an underclass. Now, this is a pretty hard-hitting little piece, which was a piece on a kind of review that, I think it's Heffer, isn't it, that does this particular piece on a Saturday. But when you look at this, the killing of Reese Jones, this particular individual lived in a family. Well, it was hardly a family. It wasn't a family. His mother, as I say, was a prostitute. His father was who knows where. And he was allowed to be feral as he grew up on the council estates in Liverpool. And is it any wonder that he therefore went into the gang culture himself? Because what you're looking at then is it goes into the gang culture as a means of gaining family. He's looking for a family, desperately looking for a family, and the only family he can find on a place like that is the very gang itself. And we have the same problem over in California, in Los Angeles, and virtually every major city within the United States. In fact, every major city probably throughout the entire world. Because we're not designed, we weren't made, we weren't created to be in cities. We're created to be living in families. Families that are in rural environments predominantly, not in the kind of cities that we've got today anyway. Yeah, about 2 years ago, I spoke on the subject of the sacred family unit. And if you'd like to go and download that sometime, listen to it, by all means do so. I'll cover certain points today, which I've covered in that particular sermon. But I expand a little bit more on the sacred family unit and show how, in fact, the unit itself is a sacred unit on the mat of a man, his wife, their children. And this is what's happening within the society today, is that unit is being destroyed. It's being undermined all the time. And say, I spoke on it about a couple of years ago. Last week, I spoke on the marriage team. Well, I want to continue with that topic. And rather than talking about the marriage team, I want to talk about the family team. I want to talk about the family team and just remind us what Mr. Armstrong said over in the Good News in August 85. This was literally months before he died, just a few months before he died. This article came out, "Where is this breakdown in family life taking us?" This was in the Good News. And he makes a comment there. He says, "Nothing in this material world is as important as a happy home life with father, mother, and well-taught, happy children, a close-knit family." Why? He asks. "It strikes at the very heart and the core of humanity's future and eternity and the gospel that Jesus Christ proclaimed." The family, the gospel is the good news of the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God is a family grown large. That's why it strikes at the very heart and core of humanity's future and eternity, at the very gospel that Jesus Christ himself proclaimed. Jesus Christ himself made the family. And so it is a vital, vital subject. There's nothing more important. In today's society, when we see the headlines that we do, it's demonstrating continually this fact, that the family team that was there at one time is now all but disappearing. And the point is that where does the next generation come from? It always, but always, but always comes from a sperm and an egg. And that sperm and an egg get together by a male and a female getting together. At least it should do. Unfortunately, today it's not quite that simple. But that's where the next generation comes from. It comes from the family unit. It comes from a husband and wife. It comes from a man and a woman. And you can either have these feral teenagers, which we've got, or you can have the kind of unit, because we don't have just a mere human brain. What we have is a human mind with a spiritual capacity. And that human mind needs the environment of a family in which to develop. That's the key ingredient that it seems to be missing in so many of these do-gooders or politicians or whatever. Today, these intellectuals today that look at the subject in an abstract way. There is a spiritual dimension. It's the missing dimension in sex that Mr. Armstrong brought out, which is revelation from God. It is a spiritual dimension because it's a spiritual union. It has got to be a spiritual union. And we within the church, it's absolutely essential that we do recognize this and that we do in fact get back on track in this area. That we do understand and go back to this book, go back to the things that we understood and we were taught, and make sure we've got this absolutely firm within our minds. Because not only is it a case that in the material world, it's as important as a happy home, nothing's as important as a happy home with father, mother, and well-taught, happy children, a close-knit family, but the reason for that is that it goes to the very heart and core of the future of humanity. It's eternity, as Mr. Armstrong says. The very gospel that Jesus Christ proclaimed. That's why it is so absolutely vital. And when we look at what's about to take place in the world, when we look at the fact that we're going into a time of such trouble, such turmoil on the earth, that there has never been a time like it, and there will never be again, then the question mark comes, why? Where has this generation been developed that produces what we're about to go through, what we're about to witness? And it goes right back to the families in which these people were actually raised. So the family life that we've got today is destined to spawn the greatest time of trouble that the world has ever seen. Now, if that's the case, there's a very good chance that our family lives are not the way they should be. our family lives are not reflecting the ways of God. And within the church, that is true. I continually come across problems within the church that go right back to family life, particularly where you've got children in the very early years. Very early years. It seems as if people, you know, they just seem that they cannot shake it. It takes enormous effort, enormous resources, enormous spiritual resources to take themselves back on the track that they need to. Whereas somebody that hasn't gone through the trauma that they maybe have gone through in the very early years don't have that problem. And so it is something which we really do need to look at, particularly in the junction that we find ourselves in history, just before a time of trouble greater than anything that has happened before. The four points I want to go into today is I want to talk about a cause for every effect. If there is an effect, if there is a problem with the family life, there is a cause. And this is true, not just of family life. This is every single thing that you find within society. If there is an effect there, there is a cause for that effect. And the cause invariably is that we've gone away from God's law. That we've gone away from the way which God has implemented. And that's the heart and core of it. And when we're looking at the family being in chaos, which it is, the problem with it is that we've gone away from the way of God. That's the heart and core of the problem. So secondly, I want to talk about the way God intended. And if you like, God's cause, what was necessary as far as God was concerned, that would then produce all the abundance that was necessary, that we'd look for. Thirdly, I want to talk about a role which today's world is, you know, lacking greatly, and it's a role that has been attacked by Satan over and over and over again, and that is the role of the Father. So the vital role of the Father. And finally, I want to talk about family blessings, because that's what God intends for us, that we are blessed. He says, all that came before me, Christ said, were thieves and robbers, and they came not except to kill and to destroy. He said, I've come that they may have life and may have it more abundantly. That's why Christ came. That's why the law of God is there. It's to protect the various things which are good, to make sure that we do have those things that are good, to keep us away from things that are bad. And certainly the family blessings will then flow from that applying that way and putting back the vital role of the Father into the family. So let's have a look at the cause for every effect. And in doing so, let's turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 2, first of all. 2 Timothy chapter 2. But he says to Timothy in verse 15, it says, study to show yourself approved to God, a workman that needs not be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. That's where you go to. He's saying to Timothy, he says, go to the word of God, rightly divide it, understand what it actually has to say. But shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase into more ungodliness. In other words, get away from the babblings that you find many times as far as the world is concerned. In so many times that you'll find that the world has a certain view of certainly the families, which literally is vain babblings. I mean, here's one that actually was from today's paper. It says, a devout registrar loses gay marriage case. It says, a Christian registrar was not entitled to refuse to marry gay couples, an employment tribunal has indicated. Lillian Liddell, who claimed that she was treated like a pariah for refusing to carry out civil partnership ceremonies for homosexual couples and was threatened with dismissal, lost her case on appeal. There's your vain babblings. That's the vain babblings. That's what it's baffle gab. I mean, this term that Mr. Pippi uses is baffle gab. And quite frankly, I love it. I really love it because it does really sum up. It's total baffle gab. Let's have a little bit more baffle gab. It's something that Adele showed me last week. Speaker fights Harman's plan for big increase in gay MPs. Controversial government-backed plans for a massive increase in the number of gay MPs, that's Member of Parliament, are being opposed by Common Speaker Michael Martin. It was revealed last night. Now, isn't it interesting they would be trying to get rid of Michael Martin? They've been trying to do it almost saying that, oh, well, he allowed the police to go ahead and raid the offices of an MP, and therefore he should go and all this rest. Is that really the reason they're trying to get rid of him? Or is this the reason? Because he's opposing this. It says, ministers are likely to support a demand by gay rights campaigners for a target of electing 39 openly gay MPs, nearly four times the present number. Why? Because that reflects society, they say. It goes on, it says, he said that the target, now this is this guy from Stonewall, he said that the target of 39 could be achieved over a period of years by measures including, quote, mentoring of gay aspiring MPs by current gay MPs and training courses run by Parliament and all main political parties to encourage more gays to enter politics. Ms. Harman, told MPs last week that Stonewall would play a vital part in that review. That's the way it is. They are trying to homosexualize the parliament and make it compulsory. You know, if you're not homosexual, you can't come into parliament. You can't stand as a candidate because we've got to have a representative cycle. As it says here, shun profane, vain babblings. Go back to the word of God, study, it says here, rightly dividing the word of truth, because anything that is vain babblings will increase unto more ungodliness. And notice the context of this verse in chapter 3. This know also that in the last days perilous times shall come. Times of stress, when a boy returning from football can't walk across a car park. Why? Because you've got some thug on one side and a bunch of thugs on the other carrying out gang violence. Where do they come from? Families raised by a prostitute. You know, the whole thing, it just gets worse and worse and worse. The perilous time shall come, for men shall be lovers of themselves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection. You better believe it's without natural affection. You talk about without natural affection. Let me read you some quotes. You know, where does this these concepts come from? Here is certain concepts from feminist writers, primarily back in the 1970s, the new feminism that used to come out at that particular time. Let me give you some quotes. It says, Gloria Steinem says, quote, by the year 2000, we will, I hope, raise our children to believe in human potential, not God. So again, the actual direction that the whole movement was going was away from God. And there is a cause, I say, for every effect, but it is to get away from God. Sheila Cronin, it says, since marriage constitutes slavery for women, it's clear that women's movement must concentrate on attacking this institution. Freedom for women cannot be won without the abolition of marriage. Now that's where it came from. That's where we've got the problem from today. Because these quotes are coming, as I understand them, from the 70s. She goes on, writes in the National Organization of Women's Time, says that, quote, the simple fact is that every woman must be willing to be recognized as a lesbian to be fully feminine. That was the movement. That was where it came from. And as I say, there is a cause for every effect. What we're looking at now, the destruction of the family, was caused by feminism back in the 70s. And a certain approach unto life that came from the 60s, where God is dead. And the 60s movement. The Declaration of Feminism, written in November 71. Hear the feminist agenda from that document. And it says, quote, the end of the institution of marriage is necessary for the liberation of women. Therefore, it's important for us to encourage women to leave their husbands and not live individually with men. That was encouraged. That's what they were aiming for. All of history must be rewritten in terms of oppression of women. And notice this next quote. We must go back to ancient female religions like witchcraft. Do you know what they say? I mean, do you know what the Gnostic heresy was? That they used to have. Basically, what they used to say is that the serpent that went to Eve was actually a being which was an androgynous being. In other words, neither male or female, which is true. And that androgynous being was in fact there to give Gnostic knowledge to Eve. so that she could be released from this terrible world where you've got physical things that have been created by this terrible God. And that's the Gnostic heresy. Now, it comes through in all kinds of different forms, but when it comes to today, this, where it says, you know, get rid of all the oppression of women, we must go back to ancient female religions like witchcraft. And that is where, that's where you see. I mean, what do we got? You know, Harry Potter, where does it come from? Witchcraft. And you wonder where we've got the problems, why we've got the problems in society? We in the church had better make sure that we don't get this kind of attitude of mind. We've got to make sure we understand where it came from. And yet, you know, you wonder whether you're looking at the problems within the church itself. Remember, quote, we are family, unquote, within the church. And what was the definition of family at that time? If you go back and you read what was being written at that time, you'll find that it includes slaves. It doesn't mean there's a God, that we're actually sons of God. Born again doesn't really mean that we're sons of God. It includes slaves and other members of the household. That's all it means. And they actually get rid of that sacred unit. They actually undermine that sacred unit. And that happened within the church. At the same time, you're looking here, the same time, you go back to the 70s. And this is where it all came from. It's flowing from where? From witchcraft. From a mindset that is governed by witchcraft. Notice another one. Dr. Mary Jo Bain, a feminist, assistant professor of education at Wellesley College, and associate director of the school's Center of Research on Women, said, quote, in order to raise children with equality, we must take them away from families and communally raise them. That is the philosophy of the feminist movement. Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, writing on articles called Women in the New Race, says, quote, and notice this one, the most merciful thing, this is Planned Parenthood, right? The most merciful thing a large family can do to one of its infant members is to kill it. Is to murder it. And you wonder where the abortion comes from? That's where. That is exactly where. And yet how many of us really understand where it came from? Really can see? And here in 2 Timothy 3, it says, Without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, that's sexually incontinent. You know, they can't basically control themselves sexually. Fierce, despisers of those things that are good. Traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Denying the authority that is there. These are the causes for every effect. This is what we're looking at today. And it's the source of the next generation, which then goes into the tribulation, which causes the very, very problems within the tribulation, which is a man-induced thing. It's a humanly induced thing as far as the tribulation. And then comes the day of the Lord where God steps in and sorts the problem out. But it says, for this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women, laden with sins, led away with different lusts. And look at the Sean Mercer and the problems that are there. For ever learning, never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Intellectuals, analysing, doing their reports, apart from what is obvious. But in verse 13, but evil men, seducers, shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. They seduce and they deceive and they deceive themselves. But you continue in the things that you've learnt and you've been assured of, knowing of whom you've learnt them, and that from a child you have known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise to salvation through the faith that is in Christ Jesus, the kind of faith that Christ had in the Father, the kind of faith that we need in this time ahead. Living in this current world, living in this current world with this baffle-gab, the profane and the vain babblings. All scripture is given by inspiration of God. It's God-breathed. It's coming from the very Spirit of God. And it's profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction in righteousness, that a man of God may be perfect, thoroughly furnished to all good works. But we see so much within our current society, which is, you know, disintegrating. Turn over to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. It says, and this is the problem, here is the heart and core of the problem, the cause for every effect that we are seeing within our society. It says in verse 5, it says, for those that are after the flesh set their mind on the things of the flesh. All their education, all their knowledge is fleshly based knowledge. It has the missing dimension completely missing. The revelation from God is not there. Why not? And this is what we within the church have got to understand. We've got to make sure that we appreciate this. The reason why it's not, but they that are after the Spirit have their minds on the things of the Spirit, have a different mentality. For to be carnally minded is death. That's the direction in which it's going. It leads to death. But to be spiritual minded is life and it's peace. It allows the peace within our households. It allows the peace within the very family unit. And as I say, the cause for every effect, just as you have the cause on the one hand for the problems that we've got in world societies today, and it's coming from the families because that's the cradle from which the very next generation comes. So the cradle from which the church comes also, we've got to make sure our families are as they should be. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God. It hates God. It actively hates God. It's against God. For it is not subject to the laws of God, neither indeed can be. It is actively against the very law of God. It does not want the law of God. It will not have the law of God. And so what happens is what you find over in Jeremiah, Jeremiah chapter 2, which I've read before, but it's certainly worth reading it again. But over in Jeremiah chapter 2, it says in verse 11, it says, has a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods, but my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. And as I said, we did have a certain semblance within our society. We lived for a while within, you know, back in the 50s and so on. There was a certain hanging on to what was right. And I know we were seeing a film the other night. It was 1935. And that particular film had, I think it was I Married My Secretary or something. Married the Boss, there we are, something like that. And it was a fairly light-hearted thing. But there was a little brat there. She was aged, what, 10, something like that, who really was misbehaving. It was the daughter of this boss. And this secretary came in to actually have a meal at the boss's home. And she played up, and the boss said, okay, and there was all kinds of problems within the home, and the secretary was so good at work, he said, well, can you look after the home for me? Can you get everything licked into shape? And he says, yes, I'll leave it. If I get complete control, I'll lick it into shape. And the first thing she did was march into the daughter's bedroom and said, this is going to hurt you more than it hurts me. The door closed, and she had a paddle in her hand, and she spanked the living daylights out of this little girl. Could that be done today in the films? Would you ever see such a thing today in the films? But that was the approach. That was 1935. That was 1935. Why? Because it was based on the laws of God. It based on the mind of God that you find within Scripture. And that was not a problem. That's not child abuse. But you know, you find today that you've got people held up for child abuse for that. And yet when you find today, it's like this article from November the 17th. It says, many adults are living in fear of teenagers. Much of the public is scared of teenagers, with half saying that they behave like animals and pose an increasing danger, according to a survey. More than a third of adults said that our streets were infested by young yobs, and 4 in 10 referred to children. That's 4 in 10 referred to children as feral in a survey for the children's charity Barnardo's, which said that it was shocked by the findings. The charity begins a campaign today that urges the public to be more tolerant. In other words, again, more baffle gap, more total baffle gap. But what is it? Your nation changed their gods that are yet no gods, but my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. Be astonished, you heavens, at this. Be horribly afraid. Be very desolate, says the Eternal. And remember, that Eternal is the one that became Jesus Christ. For my people have committed two evils. They've forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. It was the words that came to Israel of old and to Israel now is living waters. They're living waters from the very Spirit of God. All Scripture is God-breathed, is by inspiration of God, by the living waters. They've forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and they've hewn them out cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot even hold any water. Their ideas are bereft of anything of spiritual value. And yet, what about the cause for every effect? Well, that's the cause. There is the cause. And you have articles such as this, bad parents have caused Britain's decline since the 1950s, said the MP. And also another one, an article here, or a letter here about mother's ruin. And it talks about, maybe correct in his view, that the collapse of the art of good parenting has been a key factor in the decline in British society since the 1950 report in November 27th. What he doesn't mention, however, is that the fundamental change that has occurred in the role of a mother since this time. And the mother's role has fundamentally changed, and it is encouraged to be changed by the government. And then we wonder why. Because there is a cause for every effect. And that cause is a moving away from the ways of God and a moving to anything else. It doesn't matter what it is. It's moving away to anything else, away from the ways of God. We've got to go back to that. We've got to go back on track. We've got to make sure that we move back in God's direction, in our minds. Whether we have children or grandchildren or whether we don't, it makes no difference. We've got to make sure that this is something that we do. Now, the way, the things that actually, if you like, the cause that God has is something that God has given to us and makes very, very clear. He makes this, there's a comment here, this is over in, let's see, if I take it out of this folder, isn't it? There we go, I'll actually read it then. This is from Tuesday, December the 2nd. It says, "This lonely life, Britons feel the impact of fading family ties." Says Britain has become a much lonelier place over the last 30 years, according to research. Now that's the last 30 years. So where does that take you back? Back into the 70s, 60s? You're looking at a time, quite frankly, where even then that doesn't compare to the preceding 20 years, back into the 50s. And it doesn't compare to going back into the 30s again, as I say, this film that we saw the other night. And it says, "Analysts of official data show that many more people live isolated existences than in the previous generations, as the ties of family, work and community life are severed. Far more people live alone, are single and are more fearful in their communities than they were more than three decades ago, according to the study." Professor Daniel Dorling, who led the research at the University of Sheffield, said that findings painted a bleak picture of the future of British communities. Quote, "Even the weakest communities in 1971 were stronger than any community now." The weakest were stronger than any community that you find today. He said in his report entitled, quote, "Changing the UK, the way we live now." And then in another quote, it says, "If recent trends continue into the coming decades, although we may not notice the change year on year, like lobsters not noticing the heat turning up in the pan, Britons will come to live in an extremely segregated, fragmented and alienated society in the future." He and his team of researchers said that the feelings of loneliness weakened the social glue that bound communities together, and the result was that people became less trusting, more fearful of their neighbours. And that is true. That is what we're finding today. We are finding this a great deal. And again, you look at the root cause of some of these things. We were talking to somebody the other day whose sister was working in childcare, was being trained in childcare. Not only was she being trained and indoctrinated and trained how to put pressure on parents to have various immunizations or whatever the government determined that they should have, regardless of whatever risks there may be, and being trained in the techniques of putting pressure on parents for this, which she didn't agree with. What she was actually being trained in was to do with the way in which she addressed the children. The way that she was supposed to be addressing the children was not as boy or girl, but as child. And that was the clinching, that was the clincher, as far as she was concerned. And the reason for that is because they may change their mind later on. They may want to be, they might have been born a girl, but they want to change into a boy later on. They may have been born a boy, but want to change into a girl later on. And you can't do that. You can't funnel them in a certain direction. So she was being trained in this transgender bafflegab. She finally packed it all up and left. But the childcare workers, these are childcare workers that are being trained today, are being trained in that kind of nonsense. That is what's coming. I say, the way, the things of God, what actually happens? Let's turn over to Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19. But in Matthew chapter 19, we find in verse 3, it says, "The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, and saying to him, Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause?" Here's the Pharisees coming unto him and asking him the question. "And he answered and said to them, Have you not read that which was made them? At the beginning he made them male and female." It wasn't some kind of transgender nonsense. Now, yeah, sometimes you may have an hermaphrodite on a minuscule amount of cases where there may be surgery necessary and there may be that they choose one way or the other. But that is minuscule, absolutely minuscule. And it's a result of some problem physically, some major problem physically. But it does very, very, very occasionally occur. "But he made them male and female." That's the way they were made. That's the creation. Anything other than that is a deviancy. It is a perversion from the way it was created. And he says, "For this reason shall a man leave his father and mother and shall stick to his wife, and the two of them shall be one flesh. Therefore they're no more two, but they're one flesh." There's your family unit. So when you're looking at the way of God, the cause of God, that's where you go back to. And this was the one that actually implemented this family unit. And it says here, "They're no more two, but they're one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, do not let man put asunder." The unit that God has created, don't let man start messing around with that unit. And that was the word of Christ. And yet we find this kind of nonsense that you find so much in society being reflected in the churches. No, not hopefully not the true church of God, but we do find within society, we find the churches outside certainly reflecting this. If we go back to Genesis chapter 2, and it's interesting that when you're looking at what we had before, as I said before, this concept that was introduced in the church, that we are family. But it then tried to redefine family. It redefined family as being, oh, well, it could be some slaves with it. It could be include all kinds of other people. It was merely a household. And that's the way we look at it. It's not really born again. And what do we find within government? We find Mr. Cameron saying things like, well, when I say family, I mean a man and a woman, or a man and a man, or a woman and a woman. And then he redefines what is meant by family. God defines what that family is, and it's defined very clearly here. It says in verse 18, "The eternal God said, It's not good that a man should be alone. I'll make a help that is suitable for him." There are two halves to the whole, a man and a woman. Two halves, two separate halves. But the two together make the whole. "And out of the ground he formed every beast of the field. He saw what he would name them. And Adam gave names to the cattle. But there was no help that was suitable," in verse 20, and end of verse 20. "And the eternal God," that was Jesus Christ, "caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh thereof. And the rib which the eternal God had taken from man, he made a woman and brought her to the man." And again, he didn't have to do it this way. It didn't have to be written this way. It didn't have to be described this way. It is so that you see these two halves being one, being of one mind, being of one function, going in one direction, being one unit. "And Adam said, This is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She'll be called woman because she was taken from a man. And therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall stick to his wife, and the two of them shall be one flesh." So you've got a father and a mother that have children, one unit. The children grow up. They then marry themselves and they become a new unit, one unit again. Into which children can be born, in which children can be raised, and you therefore have the right kind of cradle, mental cradle I'm talking about, for the next generation, for the minds of the next generation to be reared by. And again, when we're looking at all the baffle gab that we find in society today, that is eroding this, that is removing this. Another point that we need to notice is if we turn over a couple of pages to Genesis 5, and it talks about there, it says, "This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day that God created man, in the likeness of God made he him. Male and female created he them, and he blessed them and called their name Adam." Or that is Adam brought from the earth. That's what it literally means. "In the day that they were created. And Adam lived 130 years and begat a son in his own likeness and called his name Seth. And the days of Adam," and so on. And it says, "And Seth lived," verse 6, 105 years and begat Enos. And Seth lived after. And each of the generations thereafter was actually drawn on the man's genealogy all the way through. Because from God it came to Adam, the man. From Adam, the man, it came through him to his son. From that son to the next son, all the way down, giving the genealogy that is here. And that is the genealogy looked at within Scripture. It is a male-oriented genealogy. Now, when we find other genealogies, the area that you'll find the other genealogies, and this is something that we come across within Africa, is that the African, one of the phrases is that the child belongs to society. That is an African view of life. Because why? Because you've got this polygamy. And the polygamy means that the child belongs to the tribe. The tribe then looks after. Now, it has certain great benefits. I'm not decrying the benefits. And certainly, as far as the family is concerned, there is an extended family. And it is necessary for the children to learn that they are part of an extended family of aunts, of uncles, of cousins, of grandparents. And how that actually spreads out from there. That I'm not saying that is wrong in any way, shape or form at all. But the idea that a child belongs to society has now come across to our day. And it comes across in the form that the child belongs to the state. The state has its right to go ahead and make sure that that child is raised in a certain way. And so they funnel them through the school systems and they have the social services. And if the parents step out of line, the state then takes the child. That child is put into the care of the parents. As far as the way of God is concerned, the parents are the ones who are responsible for that child. Their child is given to those parents in trust as part of that family unit, as part of that core family unit, put into, the, as I say, that womb, if you like, of the family, the womb of the very mind of the next generation that generates the next generation. Turn over to Malachi chapter 2. This is why God hates divorce, Malachi chapter 2. But in Malachi chapter 2, it says in verse 11, it says, "Judah has dealt treacherously, and an abomination is committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the holiness of the Eternal, which he loved, and has married the daughter of a strange God." Now this applies, this way of God, applies not only to the physical relationship of marriage, it applies to the spiritual relationship of marriage as well. And we go aside from the way in which God instructs us spiritually, and we therefore divorce ourselves from the spiritual way of God, and it's then described in Revelation as being the work of a whore, being the work of a prostitute, and it's described in that way because it's against the very ways of God. But he says in verse 12, it says, "The Eternal will cut off the man that does this, the master, the scholar, the tabernacle," in other words, all the intellectuals, doesn't matter what kind of intellectualism that you've got, all the intellectuals will be cut off, will be removed. The intellectualism has no place in this. "Out of the tabernacles of Jacob, and him that offers an offering unto the Eternal of hosts. And this have you done again, covering the altars of the Eternal with tears, with weeping and crying out." These are the wives now, because they've divorced, because of separation, and the children as well. The wives and the children which are being broken up, particularly when you're looking at the children and the way that children are actually looked after today. And let me just read you a little bit from this article here. It says, "I've just come across your column." This is from Leslie Garner. This is a column called Life Class. And the headline is, "I've never got over the pain of being taken away from my mother and put into care as a child." It says, "I've just come across your column while surfing the net and wondered if you could help me. When I was young, I was taken into care by the local authorities for not going to school. For some reason, I couldn't leave my mother's side, possibly..." This is a man talking. "I couldn't leave my mother's side, possibly because of my violent dad. I wanted to stay at home with her at all the time and make sure that she was okay. I still have a problem with it more than 30 years later, even though I've had lots of help from psychologists and group therapies." Now, as I say, these early traumas, in my experience, they are incredibly difficult for somebody to get over. Incredibly difficult. And this is, I'm speaking from experience over years and years in the ministry and coming across problems. It goes on, it says, "The reason I'm writing is that I read some time ago that being taken into care has affected many people's lives and is very difficult to overcome." That's what he is talking about. And the answer, part of the answer that was given, it says, "We know more now about the effects of early upbringing on children. And we know that our whole future well-being can be affected by chaos and lack of affection. In her book, Why Love Matters, How Affection Shapes a Baby's Brain, Sue Gerhardt assembles the evidence for the effects of early upbringing on a child's mental and emotional development. For example, research done with Romanian orphans show that early neglect leaves the orbitofrontal cortex of the brain, and a specific area in the frontal area of the brain, the part that manages emotions, underdeveloped. When a child from a chaotic background is taken into care, their needs are complex, and the replacement of real parenting by what is rather chillingly called, quote, the corporate parent, unquote, cannot undo all the damage. In fact, the inadequacies and inconsistencies of corporate parenting can actually compound difficulties. It is actually better to leave that child in the care of the parent and then work with the parent. That's God's way. That's God's way. You go into the law of God and read what it says in the law of God. But here in chapter 2 of Malachi, and it says, "You've covered the altar of the Eternal with tears, with weeping and crying out." And it says, "Inasmuch as his regards not the offering anymore, receives it with good will at your hand." In other words, what you are is so loud I can't hear what you say. That's basically what it's saying. "Yet you say, why? Because the Eternal has been witness against you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously. Yes, yet it is she, the companion, your companion, and the wife of your covenant. And did not he make one? Yet had he the residue of the Spirit? And why one? That he may seek a godly seed." It is one unit in order to have the right environment for the children to be born into. A godly seed. "Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously against the wife of his youth." You get the spiritual element put right. Make sure the spiritual aspect's right, because when you've got a child that comes into this environment within the family, it is a spiritual thing. It is a spiritual nurturing that has to take place. The way of God, God's cause that will bring the effect, it's coming from a spiritual perspective, and it's got to be within our own families and make sure that that spiritual perspective is there and that we don't take on board the ideas that come out of this world. But we take the spiritual aspects of loving our children in the same kind of way that God loves us. And he gives his life for us, and Jesus Christ certainly did. And notice in Malachi chapter 4, if you turn over the page, it says, "Behold, I'll send you," in verse 5, "Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Eternal." And remember, when we're looking at the dreadful day of the Eternal and the tribulation that precedes it, that's coming out of what? Well, the cusp of a family situation. That's where the generation comes from. It comes from a family. And so what happens? "And he shall turn..." Or turn back the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse or with utter destruction. So the elect have got to get their family life sorted out. We have got to have the family life sorted out. And we have been given what we need. The missing dimension has been given to us. And that missing dimension is the revelation from God. It's a revelation from God. Read The Missing Dimension in Sex again. Go back and read it, because it's certainly a great deal more than just, you know, sexual areas. It goes to the actual spiritual areas predominantly, particularly the first half of the book is talking about the physical areas, the spiritual areas. Okay, going on to point number three, the father needs to be put back as the vital role, the vital God-given role. If we turn back to Isaiah 57, in Isaiah 57, today what we do find is we find repeatedly single parent households, and these single parent households, let's look and see what this one is. Yeah, let me just read a little bit here. This is from, let's see, what's the date on this one? This is Saturday, December the 6th, so a week ago, or a couple of weeks ago. It says, in the 70s, only 11% of households on the estates weren't working. These are on the county council estates. They're here in the UK. Only 11% weren't working. Today, barely a third of working age tenants have full-time work. Two-thirds are without work. Barely a third. Actually have full-time work. Less than 15%, notice, less than 15% are headed by a couple with children. So all the others are different. Two-thirds are occupied by lone parents, lone men, or lone women. This is the change that has taken place over the last few years. On such estates, few children see a positive father figure, with young men having children by different mothers, with the state covering the costs. Small wonder that alcoholism rates are high, drug dealers ply their trade in full view of young families, and this social breakdown leads far too many young boys into street gangs. So it gives the problems that we read about earlier, this Sean Mercer, that actually has just been rocked away for 22 years. So it leads far too many young boys into street gangs. Although gangs are criminal and bound together by harsh discipline, the leaders act as an authority figure, and the gang's strong ties and loyalties perversely replicate the family that they never had. Now this is Ian Duncan Smith who's writing this. He's an MP who recognises the problem. But they recognise that the family is giving them the family figure that they never had. The gang is. As gangs clash, residents suffer from the violence and high levels of crime. These young boys are on their way to a life of crime. You don't have to take my word for it. Look at the background of those who are as young offenders and end up in custody. Over three quarters of them are from broken homes. Just under half of them experience violence in the home, and half of them have an education level below an 11-year-old. And so when you find here in Isaiah 57, it says here in verse 1, it says, the righteous perish, no man lays it to heart, and merciful men are taken away, none considering that the righteous is taken away from the evil to come. He will enter into peace, and they will enter into their rest in their beds, each one working walking in his uprightness. But you draw near hither, you sons of the sorceress, the seed of the adulterer and the whore. Against whom are you sporting yourself? Against whom do you make wide your mouth and draw out the tongue? Aren't you the children of transgression, a seed of falsehood, inflaming yourself with idols under every green tree? So the problem was there in times past, but they saw it for what it was. And it was the adulterer and the whore that gave rise to a certain degenerate lifestyle that therefore gave rise to a degenerate children. But we have council estates filled with such children based on what? The feminism of the 70s and the lack of a morality that goes back into the 60s. And here we have the cause. But if you go over to... And what is the problem here? Why are these children a major problem as far as here in Isaiah 57? What is the problem? There is no father. With you've got a whore and you've got a seed of falsehood, where's the father? We've got no idea. This was Sean Mercer's problem. There was no idea, as far as the father was concerned. It was some relationship that obviously, because his mother was a prostitute. And this is exactly what's being said here. It has had the same effect today, and we've got to make sure we understand that. If we go over to Revelation 14, we find the way in which God, in sending Jesus Christ, is re-establishing the authority of, if you like, the Father. This is Revelation chapter 14. It says in verse 1, it says, I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having the Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and the voice of a great thunder, and the voice of harpers harping with harps, and they sung a new song. And it says, these are they, verse 4, that are not defiled with women. So spiritually, they're not sleeping with the enemy. They don't go ahead and they are not defiled with false churches, false ideas, false philosophies, the Baphlagab of today's world. For they are virgins. They are also, they follow the Lamb wherever he goes. They're redeemed from among men, being the first fruits to God and the Lamb. As I mentioned before, they appear to be a group of individuals that are not here now. They're not here yet. Or they probably are here now. But they will arise in the tribulation, from what it seems, and then will be protected in the day of the Lord, because the mark is set on them. And they appear to be actually accompanying Christ, and in accompanying Christ are used in reconciling Israel again, because they've gone through what Israel will have gone through. And there, as it mentions in Revelation 9, is it, that talks about the different tribes that they come from. So they are actually Israelites. It says, in their mouth was find no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. So these people are before the throne of God, they're working with Christ. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to them that dwell on the earth. And here is the gospel, here is the good news, here is the heart and core of that gospel. And it says, to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God, give glory to him. For the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven, earth, the sea, the fountains of water. And there followed another angel saying, you know, Baphlagab is fallen. That's basically what they're saying, because that's what Babylon is. It's a confusion of the word. But the word that went out by that angel is this, it is a gospel message. It is a gospel message about the government of God on the world. And the government of God is the government of a creator God. And as far as the Father is concerned, the Father creating things through Jesus Christ, but nevertheless he's a creating God. And he's certainly, the sovereignty of the God's family is absolutely essential. If we go back into Hebrews chapter 12, we find that God actually works with us today as well. And he's working with us as a father would work. Again, using analogies that are here mentioned in Hebrews chapter 12. It says, therefore, verse 1, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside the weight and the sin that easily besets us, and run with patience the race that's set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. So consider him, because you, verse 4, you haven't resisted blood. And have you forgotten, verse 5, the exhortation which speaks to you as to children? My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and he scourges every son, he spanks every son that he receives. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as sons. For what son is it that the father doesn't spank? That's what it says. But if you are without chastening, without spanking, therefore of all which are all are partakers, you are bastards and you are not sons. And this is the problem that we see within society, that there is not the authority figure of the father in so many of these cases. I just noticed, I downloaded, I was looking for something else actually, but I happened to come across a blog by a certain black guy. It's called blackvoicenews.com. And he mentions in there, he says, Californian State Assemblywoman Nancy Lieber has reintroduced her anti-spanking bill to the Californian State Assembly. The bill amends the current child abuse statute to now define as child abuse spanking with an implement such as, quote, a stick, a rod, a switch, an electrical cord, an extension cord, a belt, a broom, or a shoe, unquote. There are more than a few grandmas that will find themselves on the way to the pokey if this bill passes. You know, that basically is what used to happen. As I said, 1935, we watched that film. And they said, are you giving me full authority over this family? Yes, sort it out. Right, first thing he did was march into that young girl's room, 10-year-old, put her over her knee and spank her bottom for her because she'd well overdue. And she brought peace, then started to descend on the family. She also fired some of the servants that had been actually stealing from the family. She marched through and did, you know, what needed to be done. Now, it's a shame that the father didn't do that, but the father was so involved with his business that he neglected his family. And then what happened then in the film, again, the reflecting the state of mind, was that the secretary was actually posted to another branch of a stores that the boss actually owned, and she gave advice to a young upcoming PA, say, look, go and, you know, leave work and go and get some time off work because your boyfriend and having a right kind of family life and a right kind of marriage is far more important than anything that you can do here. Again, you try doing that today. You try doing that today. It says, the current law already makes it a crime for any person to, quote, willfully cause harm or inflict upon a child unjustifiable physical pain or mental suffering, unquote. What can be gained by amending this language other than to have social workers and police officers second-guessing parents when they choose to use corporal punishment to discipline their children? It is also notable that Lieber has no children of her own, which makes you think. Certainly the irony of a woman that has never raised children presuming to legislate how parents can and can't discipline their children can't be lost on the bill's supporters. But this is the problem. It's come from intellectuals that haven't a clue. It's bafflegab again. He goes on, he says, as a parent, it's my duty to prepare my children for an independent... He mentions, I'll just read this, he says, I have from time to time engaged in a bit of tactile aid with my sons. And he then says, as a parent, it's my duty to prepare my children for an independent adult life. Discipline is a way of teaching my children lessons that are meant to ensure that they become contributing members of society rather than parasites upon that society. This is a father speaking with some common sense. I'm of the mind that these lessons will either be absorbed through the head or the bottom. And that's what I used to say to my kids. You know, if I can talk to you, I'll talk to you. If I can't talk to you, I'll still talk to you. But it'll be a different talking. I tell my sons the choice is theirs. My sons have weighed the alternatives and found it much easier to learn their lesson from the top down rather than from the bottom up. And I thought that was very good. I thought it was very appropriate. But, you know, the interesting thing, or the absolute irony, is that Lieber, who is Nancy Lieber, bringing this kind of nonsense in, has no children, has never raised children, doesn't have a clue what she is talking about. And here in Hebrews, it says... Furthermore, in verse 9, Hebrews 12:9, it says, furthermore, we are fathers of our flesh, which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much more rather be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us. They spanked us after their own pleasure. But he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Again, it shows us there is a family relationship. And the family relationship is Christ and the church, yes. But it's also that we have a father who loves us and a father figure that we look to. And who will correct us? Now, no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterwards it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those that are exercised thereby. Therefore, lift up the hands that hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way. In other words, instead of being turned away from the way of God, and let it rather be healed. make sure that we're not bastards. We are sons of God, sons of God in the making. And he will, in fact, therefore, help us and guide us as a loving father. And we have to do the same within our own families. And we've got to submit to that loving authority of God the Father and Jesus Christ within the church and make sure that we are submitting in the right way. Turn over to Ephesians 6. Ephesians chapter 6. Now in Ephesians 5, it says in verse 20, giving thanks always for all things unto God. It says 21, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. That is the crucial area. Submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. And he then explains, and we read through it last time, in verse 22, wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as to the Lord. That is the way in which the wife submits to the husband in this case, as in the fear of God, in the fear of God, in doing it God's way. And then it says, verse 25, husbands, love your wife, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. Again, how the husband then submits to his wife, loving, giving to that wife, being whatever he does is done for her benefit, for the benefit of the family. And that, again, is the way in which he submits to her. That's the one it's talking about, each one. And then in chapter 6 and verse 1, it tells about talking about children and the way the children submit. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. So that, again, is a command to the children, and it is also a command as far as the parents, the husbands and wives are concerned, to encourage their children to be submissive, to live in the right kind of relationship, to get the right structure within this family unit, where the father is the head, being placed there by the wife who submits. It's not the father wielding the big stick, it's the wife that submits. But he is the head to administer loving care and authority within that home, within that separate unit. And it says, and you fathers, and here is how it's supposed to be done. This is the way the fathers submit to their children. It says, do not provoke your children to wrath, but you bring them up in the nurture, in the discipline, in the admonition of the Lord. You instruct them, you help, you guide them. And certainly, this is something that we all need to be aware of within our today's society, is that the fathers need to be put back into their vital God-given role. It is not an oppression of the home. It is not ruling with a big stick at all. It is there to serve the home, and it is the wife's job to make sure that the father is placed into that position, and that the children also recognize that position. Then the thing works smoothly. Then you have what is necessary. And as that man said in that article, you know, you can either do it from the top down or from the bottom up. It's much better from the top down. Teach, help, encourage, exhort, instruct. This is what the home is for. This is what the family is for. It's to make sure that there you've got a crucible in which the spiritual minds of the next generation are being generated. We've got to teach this in the future. This is why it's so absolutely vitally important that we're looking at this subject, this family unit, but it's this family team. It's a family team. It's a team effort on all sides. It's a team effort by children. It's a team effort by the fathers. It's a team effort by the mothers, all working together as a family unit, as a mirror of the spiritual relationship that we are going to enjoy for eternity. And that then gives a blessing. It gives a very, very clear blessing. And it is interesting that as far as the blessing is concerned, we need to be aware that we are the right kind of example. It's absolutely crucial that example is there. First of all, however, let's just turn over to Titus. Titus chapter 1. Titus chapter 1. Because it says in Titus chapter 1, in verse 14, It says, not giving heed to Jewish fables and the commandments of men that turn from the truth. Now, there were some kind of fables going around at that time that Paul was writing to Titus that he says, look, you don't go ahead and get bogged down in that kind of bafflegab. That's what he's talking about. But in Titus chapter 2, it says, verse 1, it says, but you speak the things which become sound doctrine, sound teaching, that the aged men be sober, grave, temperate, and sound in faith, in charity, and in patience, or not charity, in agape, in love. And again, agape isn't just love. It's more than that. It is outgoing concern. It is a character trait. It's a character which is outgoing, a character which you will do the best for the other person, whoever that other person is, be it a child, be it a husband, be it a wife, you will do, or be it an enemy, you will do the best for them. And this is why God can love the world, and he will also execute. He will put people out of their misery, because it will still be love. It will still be agape. It's not kind of soft, sanctimonious, syrupy form of love. It is a form of love that is going for the best for that other individual. And we must also make sure that sound in faith, in this godly love, in patience. And it says, verse 3, the aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becomes holiness, not false accusers, not giving too much wine, teachers of good things. So you ladies that are elderly within the church, you do need to make sure that your example, that carries far more weight than anything that you can say. The example carries the greatest weight of all. That, and once they've got that example right, it says that they may teach the young men and women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, so that there is that love placed in that home, and the family blessing can come within the home, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God is not blasphemed. And as it says in verse 15, these things speak, exhort, and rebuke with all authority, and don't let any man despise you. Why? Because this is the way of God. This will produce the family blessings that are necessary. This is produce the kind of character that is necessary within this cradle, within this area of the home, developing those people that are within it. If we go back to Deuteronomy 6, and see the example there, we find here in Deuteronomy 6, verse 20, it says, and when your son asks you in times to come, saying, what does means the testimony, the statutes, the judgments which the Eternal our God has commanded you? And then you will say to your son, we were Pharaoh's bondmen in Egypt, and explain. But the son comes up and he asks the question. Now, you've got to have the right environment for that to happen. And it says over in chapter 6, notice it says in verse 4, it says, hear, O Israel, the Eternal our God is one eternal, and you shall love the Eternal your God with all your heart, your soul, and all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children. And you will talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk in the way, when you lie down, and when you raise up. So this is how it's done. You instruct in everyday life. Now, if we're not there, if the family is in total confusion, if there's no father there, the job lies to the mother to do. But quite frankly, it says that when your son asks of you, that you need to generate an environment in which the son and the daughters will actually ask questions. If you're going to watch television together so that you can then see a problem there and use it as a means of instruction, and allow that means of instruction. If you're reading papers, show and point certain papers out and point the problems there. Here's an article. This is from the Telegraph of Wednesday, November the 19th. It says, blame mummy, not Madonna. It says it's not just celebrities that undermine teenage girls' self-esteem. There's a culprit far closer at her home, says Elizabeth Grice. It says where mothers are hung up on dieting, their daughters imbibe the same dubious values, says Dean Jade, the founder of the National Center of Eating Disorders. Research shows that again and again, parents' attitude to food, weight and shape is a powerful risk factor. This is as far as bulimia and other eating disorders. It says they pass on their obsessions and anxieties to their children almost by osmosis. If a mother is constantly asking, does my bum look big in this? Then it focuses the child's attention negatively and they can develop an acquired sensitivity to such things. This is somebody, again, who is dealing with this kind of thing all the time. It says girls between 10 and 14 revealed that pressure to grow up before they were ready was overwhelming. Afraid of being singled out or isolated or excluded, they felt compelled to wear clothes that made them look older. They were then confused about how to deal with the sexual advances from boys. And they felt bombarded by magazines and websites telling them to lose weight, wear makeup, and even consider plastic surgery. It's an absolutely appalling situation that we've got when we're putting our kids through. But it says that the problem here is in this particular article, are the mothers that are actually passing on their own neuroses to the children. And the fathers as well, if the fathers are there. That's the problem with the fathers so many times, they're not there. Simply cutting off magazines or monitoring television programs will not stem the tide of undesirable influences and unhealthy role models, says Jade. It's like putting your fingers in the dike because there's no one influence. Instead, we should try to teach them some media literacy to show how these images are manipulated. It is a difficult and complex job, and very few parents are equipped for it. But here in Deuteronomy 6, it says the way you do it is that when you get up, when you sit down, when you walk in the way, wherever you are, you use it as an instruction. That is the way in, that is the way. That is the way of God. That is how we teach our children. And that is how the questions then come back. And it will say, and when your son says to you, then this is what you do. But he's not going to say anything to you unless you've got this dialogue, unless you've got this communication. And if that communication cannot be there unless, in the case of a father, the father is there, unless the mother spends time with the children. And yet so often what happens is that the television, the computer games and everything else has the preeminence. Another article which I thought was very good, it says, keep government out of childcare, says Tom Hodgkinson. So last week I spoke at the AGM of the Campaign Organisation of Full-Time Mothers, the FTM. This is a group of educated intellectual women who since 1990 have supported women who have chosen to stay at home with their children rather than, quote, go back to work, unquote, as the current slang has it. So this is an organisation to try and counter this move back to work. Says the chairman of FTM later sent me an article by the Swedish writer Anne Wahlgren, who says that the problem is that we do not see children as useful. Even from birth, they're accustomed to being viewed as an encumbrance. At best, they're encouraged to be little consumers rather than producers, and to give their lives meaning, we need to make them feel needed and get them involved in household chores, cooking, cleaning, baking bread, growing vegetables and feeding chickens. That is how you do it. You get them back to be contributors to the family. That is God's way. Kids are not designed to be just left to themselves in front of the computer game all the time. If we as parents needed our children, and little by little, according to their will and capability, we put them in good use, then we could slowly change a social order that is already shaky. This is absolutely true. I find my children are never happier than when I, for example, stuffing envelopes for a certain mail out. I get them in a little production line and they're doing something genuinely useful and they can feel it. Another example is when Arthur came into London with me for 2 days to clear out the office. He worked like a trooper. He later said that it was the most fun that he'd ever done. And kids do. They really enjoy to work. But what do you get? This baffle-gab nonsense? Or you can't have children working. Ridiculous. Of course you can and you should. All of this is, of course, excellent news for the idle parent. Children should be seen as useful additions to the family labour force rather than simply as cost and hassle. Bring back child labour. Oh, it's slightly tongue-in-cheek. But it's true that that is certainly something that needs to be done. And if we turn back to Ephesians 5, where we were before, I want you to notice something before it goes into that section that talks about to fathers and husbands, wives and children, here in Ephesians 5, it says, verse 13, but in all things that are reproved are made manifest by the light. For whatever does make manifest is light. And Christ came, he says, in him was life, and that life was the light of men. It shone, this living word shines brightly, illuminating what needs to be done, and what needs to be done within our families and homes. It says, therefore he said, awake you that sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. And he means it, literally. See then that you walk circumspectly. In other words, you use that light and look at where you're going. Not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. We live in this evil age. And when you apply that into childcare, into the family blessings, we find here that making that time, having that time is essential. And today's society, if you've got a high-power job, you will find that that will impinge on your time. You will find it impinging on your time. This world is basically a time thief. The television, the videos, the various other bits and pieces are going to impinge on that time. And you've got to be circumspect, using that light, redeeming the time because the days are evil. It doesn't mean to say you never watch a film, you never watch any television. But it says you use it carefully, you use it very diligently. We know that over in Micah 4:4 it talks about them having their own vine and their own fig tree. Well, turn to Psalm 128. Psalm 128. And notice what it says there. Because indeed, in the future there will be each one under his own vine and own fig tree, and none will make them afraid. There will be a family unit, and the family unit will be re-established in society. And we are going to have to be the ones under Christ that do that, that put the right values there, that encourage the families to eat together, to play together, to love their children, that there is this love and a bond of love between fathers and mothers that is then brings the children into that bond of love, and that there is unity and the right laws of God are therefore applied throughout the laws of God, let's face it, are about relationships. The spiritual laws of God are about relationships. And the first relationship that we are dealing with is within the family, is within husband and wife, between children. But here in Psalm 128, it says, blessed is everyone that fears the Eternal, that walks in his ways. So here is where the family blessing comes from. It's from walking in his way. That is the spiritual law of God, the very Torah. The word Torah means the way. It isn't the law, it means the way. That's what it literally means. It means what you're pointing for. For you shall eat the labor of your hands, and happy shall you be, and it will be well with you. Here is the family blessings. Here is what is needed in our societies today. Here is what the society lacks today. And yet it desperately, desperately needs. And he says, it will be well with you. Your wife will be as a fruitful vine by the sides of your house. Your children like olive plants around about your table. The kind of table is that you sit down around and you therefore talk. I know that what we used to have, whenever we used to implement it, it used to work within our own home. When I used to then start getting too busy and I used to be out and therefore wasn't able to implement it, then the home life suffered. What we used to have was family conferences. It was the time of breakfast. We used to have the family conference, get all the kids around, and anybody could go ahead and give what needed to be done, needed to be brought out, anything. And we just used to talk about whatever needs to be talked about at that time. It needs to be something similar. And then, you know, we used to have the breakfast or whatever as well. But we'd have about 5 minutes before. And we used a prayer as well at that time, from what we used to do. But your wife will be a fruitful vine by the sides of your house, your children like olive plants around about your table. Behold, that thus shall the man be blessed that fears the Eternal. It's the fear of God. And remember, it says, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. That's what it says in Ephesians. The Eternal shall bless you out of Zion. And Zion is the place of the dwelling place of God. That's where the church is. The general shall bless you out of Zion. And you will see the good of Jerusalem all the days of your life. You'll eventually see that good in Jerusalem. It says it'll comfort you in as a mother comforts a child in Jerusalem in the end of Isaiah. Yes, you will see your children's children and peace upon Israel. Eventually, these ways of God, this family unit will be there. And this family team will be built. And it will, in fact, mirror what needs to be mirrored. Because the family is that vital source of the next generation. It was seems to be lost sight of, as far as the world outside is concerned. They seem to have lost sight as to the fact that this is where the next generation comes from. This is why it is such a vital subject. And we are going to have to make sure that we teach it in the world tomorrow. And as Mr. Armstrong says, he says, nothing in this material world is as important as a happy home life with father, mother, and well-taught, happy children. A close-knit family. Why? It strikes at the very heart and the core of humanity's future and its eternity and the gospel that Jesus Christ proclaimed.